You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of September 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Just wondering, I mean, have you called French Foreign Minister, for instance?
No, but we're in the process of arranging for me to go to France and to Germany.
Do you know who he is?
Don't start pub quizzing me, Dermot.
He's the French Foreign Minister. Do you know his name?
It's probably no consolation to the UK's shadow foreign secretary, but France's foreign minister probably doesn't know who she is either. But where is the line between testing politicians on their knowledge and cheap point scoring? My guests Daniela Pellad and Robin Lustig will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including Hillary Clinton's health. Is she literally unfit to serve? South Korea's stepping up of the name-calling across the DMZ. Is it really likely to help? And are we mistaken in longing for a bygone era of more thoughtful politics and more thoughtful politicians? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Daniela Pellad, Acting Managing Editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Robin Lustig, a journalist, broadcaster, former presenter of The World Tonight on Radio 4, among much else. Welcome both. We will start tonight in the US, where Hillary Clinton's campaign for the presidency is attempting to deal with approximately the last thing it needed at this point, i.e. irrefutable footage of infirmity in the context of a memorial for September 11th. The official line is that she has something called walking pneumonia, and that this is nothing antibiotics and a few days' rest won't fix. It has, however, refocused attention on the health of both candidates. Clinton would be the second oldest president sworn in for their first term, Trump the oldest. Daniela, first of all, how big a deal actually is this?
Well, I think the biggest deal about the whole issue is that she was diagnosed on Friday, and they still wheeled her out on Sunday. And where she collapsed, and the video is so damaging. She's really, really wobbling.
But is that more damaging than I can't come to the September 11th memorial of all occasions because I'm ill?
Well, she could have said, I mean, look, pneumonia sounds very scary. It is, after all, not to minimise the plight of people who are particularly poorly with it, but it's a chest infection. So there's a way, you'd imagine some political nous, which you'd imagine that her campaign would have, is saying, well, she's a bit poorly. She's got it's an autumn cold. She might have had to cancel an appointment. You know, this was enormously damaging. And pneumonia does sound really awful. I speak from experience. Earlier this year, I had not single pneumonia, but double pneumonia, which was unpleasant. But it wasn't anything sinister. It didn't presage any particular health problems, and I did get over it. And similarly with Hillary Clinton, it's just a really, really bad chest infection. And I think it seems to have been mishandled immensely.
What do you think, Robin? Has it been mishandled? I mean, realistically, politically, I mean, it's a rotten thing to happen at any time to anybody. It's an especially rotten thing to happen when you're running for president, and it is a triply rotten thing to happen on the weekend when it's the 15th anniversary of September 11th. She had to go, didn't she?
I think she did have to go, and I entirely understand why her campaign people didn't want to be upfront about it. Nevertheless, they should have been, particularly given that Donald Trump and the Republican campaign people had been going on about her health for such a long time. Much better to be up front.
They could have said she has pneumonia and she's coming anyway.
Exactly so. That would precisely have been the thing to do. I mean, what's so dangerous about this, I think, is not that she is ill. That's one thing. But that she is apparently, again, not to be trusted. She comes out after having been wheeled away from that ceremony and been seen to stumble and tells everybody she's absolutely fine, she's feeling wonderful. She knows she has pneumonia. She's not being honest. The one thing that a lot of American voters don't like about her is they don't trust her. And she's given them yet another reason not to trust her.
Daniela, are you surprised by Donald Trump's response? I was rather myself. He's actually wished her well. And And he has promised, and, you know, we'll believe it when it happens, but he's promised to release his full medical records above and beyond the...
Physical medical records.
Well, yes.
Very good point.
We have already had an obviously ludicrous note from his doctor, which does rather sound as if Donald Trump dictated it and his resident quack signed it.
I think he was... I think the story with that that statement where the doctor basically said that Donald Trump was the finest human specimen he'd ever seen.
Words to that effect,
indeed, and Trump's people were waiting outside for him in the car. I mean, it was, you know, under duress and rather rushed. Well, this is Trump can afford to be magnanimous here because this latest blooper by Clinton comes on the heels of another really, really obvious apparent mistake, which is she called half of Trump's supporters. What did you call them?
The basket, basket of deplorables.
Deplorables. Now, surely.
Sounds like a cartoon film, doesn't it?
it sounds like a sort of a somewhat earnest post-punk band, and I suspect by now it is.
Yes, I'm thinking of a sweet sequel to The Minions, which probably tells you where I am in terms of popular culture. But it's a basic principle. You do not you aren't so gratuitously insulting to an enormous section of. The opposition's supporters.
I am massively in favour of politicians insulting the electorate. I think far more of it should go on.
It is fun. But it allows allowed Trump to score such an easy point. I fail to see what she achieved by it. And it seems to me that a lot of her campaign so far has been to appeal to people that she already appeals to.
Robin, there's many serious points underlying this, but one that occurs to me is that the US Constitution specifies a lower age limit on the presidency, which is 35. Should there be an upper limit?
Ah, well, I'm not the right person to answer that because I happen to be exactly the same age as Hillary Clinton. But no,
you're
I don't
You're not running
know.
For president,
I'm
though,
not
are
running
you?
For I president, mean, this, and I'm
you,
not sure I'd
if,
be able
if you want,
to.
If you want to announce it...
No, thank you very much.
That would have been a
apart from anything else, I'm not an American citizen. But no, be that as it may. No, I don't think there should be an upper limit, but I think it is perfectly legitimate for voters to say we would like to be assured that the candidates for the president are in reasonable health. There have been plenty of occasions in the past, of course, when the candidates weren't in reasonable health and voters didn't know that, Roosevelt being a case in point.
Kennedy being another.
He did all right, though.
He did all right for a while. No, I think it's perfectly legitimate to ask for proper health assessments to be made public. In Donald Trump's case, I think American voters do have a problem because even if he is physically fit, there are questions, in my view, legitimate questions about his mental health. Now, as far as I know, whatever health assessment he publishes will not include a psychiatric assessment. Maybe it should.
What do you think, Daniela? Can you be too old to lead a country? I mean, in most other realms in public service, in the military, in fact, and the presidency is a military rank, it's commander-in-chief, you are tossed out at a fairly early age, relatively. The current chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Joseph Dunford, is 60. That'll be his last job in the Army, or the Marines, actually, technically, where he's concerned. But beyond that point, you can't usually continue in public service.
I don't think you need to legislate for this. I think a certain amount of common sense comes into play. I do wonder how Robert Mugabe is getting along, since he is particularly... Is he 90 or 92?
Yeah, 90, yeah.
Never die.
Well, but that's not my major concern about his leadership. It does seem strange to me, as a British citizen and a voter, that Americans, they seem to fetishise this issue of health in a president. They have to be absolute prime, shining examples of physical fitness, because they're not electing an astronaut. They're electing a political leader.
And they are electing a tribal chieftain, though.
And it's true. It's true that it's the commander-in-chief. But that doesn't mean that somebody can't have a cold.
The most successful British tribal chieftain, of course, Winston Churchill, was both very old, alcohol dependent, and suffered from clinical depression, all at the time when he was Prime Minister and leading the country through the Second World War.
Well, on that happy note, we will move along. Aficionados of apocalyptic political rhetoric, and I know I'm one, have long had a friend in Rodong Sinmun, the official newspaper of the Workers' Party of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. While maintaining a vigorous line in invective towards almost everybody and everything that isn't called Kim, it is especially vehement and imaginative in its condemnations of the neighbours. In the last few days alone, through the vessel of Rodong Sinmun, North Korea has called South Korea traitors, gangsters, confrontation maniacs, and human scum branded as a disgusting waiting maid pleasing the mistress. A subtly wrought metaphor there for Seoul's relationship with Washington. But now, and not before time, South Korea seems keen to return the compliment. In response to North Korea's latest helpful nuclear test, South Korea has threatened to reduce Pyongyang, and I quote, to ashes. Daniela, given the regularity with which the North threatens to turn the South into a lake or sea or ocean of fire, that seems to be graded depending how angry they are at any point, whether it's lake, sea or ocean. Isn't this fair enough, really?
I'm surprised it took them this long. I mean, a scenario such as this, like so many similar scenarios in international relations, reminds me of nothing so much as a brawl in a bar where you have these inebriated chaps going, right, I'm going to have you, oh no, you. And they're just waiting for people to pull them apart and step in. And I mean, I think South Korea is now getting a bit ranty because it wants someone else to do something, someone else who can do something. Although who or how that will be seems rather hard to imagine. America has made some noises about, you know, flying warplanes hither and thither and stepping up sanctions, although by all accounts the sanctions are already quite threadbare. China, which is the one really holds all the cards, is I can't see any scenario in which China is going to wag its finger at this point. So I think for the moment, although we always seem to be poised on the verge of apocalypse, I think now we're on the steaming lake level, maybe, if not the... Yeah.
Before the ocean catches fire.
Robin, is this sort of language, is there a strategic logic to it under, I guess, the it's the only language they understand clause?
It's got like that, hasn't it? I mean, there does seem to be a sense in which each side says, you know, anything you can say, we can say worse. You say your dad is big, I say my dad is bigger, or whatever it might be. I'm perfectly happy, as it happens, for them to be as rude as they like about each other, as long as it remains words that they hurl across the border. Just one thing about the nuclear threats. No country on earth is going to drop a nuclear weapon on its neighbour. The thing about nuclear weapons is that they create huge amounts of radioactive dust, which goes through the air and it lands over areas of hundreds of miles. If the North drops a bomb on the South, or if the South for some reason decides to develop its own bomb and drop one on the North, they're going to kill an awful lot of their own people. It's just not going to happen.
The problem is that North Korea doesn't seem to be enough of a rational actor at times that would matter.
I think they're more rational than they sound.
We must hope so, because the thing you do always have to hope that Pyongyang appreciates is if they were to do anything precipitate with their nuclear weapons, it would be the last thing they ever did.
Exactly.
They must know that.
Exactly.
But that notwithstanding, Daniela, do we reach a point at which if they can equip, reliable nuclear missiles, if they can then fit those missiles in submarines which can roam the world's oceans undetected?
That's a lot of ifs, isn't it?
These are a lot of ifs, but over the next 5 to 10 years, they're not that unlikely. Does there become a point at which, however ghastly the risks, action becomes irresistible?
Well, it depends what action. I mean, the other risk is also how other rogue nations, so-called, view this and view the international community sort of faffing about and issuing statements, as we're very good at doing. Oh, one school of thought says, we should negotiate, we should talk to the regime. Another one says that what they're after is legitimacy. You know, I was joking about them saying that they're not rational actors, but maybe at heart, you know, they want to say, well, we want to be out there. Just say, look, we've got nuclear weapons. We're not necessarily going to use them, but hey, we want to join the gang.
I think that's exactly right. I think that's exactly what they're doing. They're not aiming their nuclear program at South Koreans. They're aiming it at the United States. They're saying to the Americans, you've got to take us seriously. We don't want to suffer the fate of Saddam Hussein. We don't want to suffer the fate of Libya. You can't do to us what you did to them. We are big players in the world. You've got to take us seriously. That's what they're saying. Now, if they're not believed, it could be dangerous. But I really don't think that what's going on at the moment is a threat to South Korea. I think what they're doing, as Daniela quite rightly says, is to try to attract the attention of the Americans and say to the Chinese also, who hold all of the strings, you can't take us for granted. We have some cards to play.
But that, again, a final thought on this from you, Daniela, that does return to the question of, and this came up a lot, I guess, and still will come up a lot in any negotiations and discussions with Iran, which is, at the end of the day, are these people rational? Are they actually thinking about the world and actions and consequences in the same way that the rest of us do? Is there a possibility that North Korea is, in fact, a sort of doomsday cult compound the size of a country?
Look, that might be the case for North Korea. I don't believe for a minute that's the case for Iran. I think Iran is definitely governed by rational objectives, competing narratives and competing powers, it's true. But if we're talking about a real rogue nation, I think North Korea fills those criteria better than any other country on the planet.
Well, let's take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Daniela Pellet and Robin Lustig. Coming up next, are they really not making politicians like they used to?
Are 3D movies strictly the domain of blockbuster multiplex madness? On this week's edition of The Cinema Show, we sit down with a giant of European cinema, Wim Wenders.
Unfortunately, it's abused and misused in such a way that it'll also in the danger of disappearing soon because people are sick and tired of it.
That's three-time Oscar nominee Wim Wenders at the 73rd Venice Film Festival. Download The Cinema Show now at monocle.com, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Mullett. Now, compare and contrast.
Crises there will continue to be. In meeting them, whether foreign or domestic, great or small, there is a recurring temptation to feel that some spectacular and costly action could become the miraculous solution to all current difficulties. A huge increase in newer elements of our defenses, development of unrealistic programs to cure every ill in agriculture, a dramatic expansion in basic and applied research. These and many other possibilities, each possibly promising in itself, may be suggested as the only way to the road we wish to travel.
Hey, I'm not saying they're stupid. I like China. I just sold an apartment for $15 million to somebody from China. Am I supposed to dislike them? I'm really rich. I'll show you that in a second. I'm not doing that to brag, because you know what? I don't have to brag. I don't have to, believe it or not. I think I am a nice person. People that know me like me.
President Dwight Eisenhower, 56 years ago, speaking to the American people as if they were, like him, educated adults capable of absorbing complicated concepts and of reasoning based on facts. And presidential aspirant Donald Trump, more recently, speaking to the American people as if they are, like him, ignorant, bigoted, self-pitying orange yahoos. Robin, first of all, is it true to suggest that politics has become irrecoverably debased?
Having just heard those two clips, there's only one conceivable answer, isn't there? But let me try and be counterintuitive. We don't know how Donald Trump would sound if he were ever president of the United States. Let me give you a British example. Boris Johnson, the British Foreign Secretary, was a bit of a buffoon before he became Foreign Secretary.
Interesting use of the word was,
yes,
but,
quite,
but
yes,
carry
but
on.
I was looking yesterday at his Twitter feed since he became Foreign Secretary, and it consists entirely of anodyne guff, such as had very interesting meeting with the foreign minister of such and such a country today. Hope relations will be continue to improve. I mean, he is trying very hard to behave himself. There is a difference between the way people behave in office and out of office. Nevertheless, you make a sort of semi-serious point. Politics has changed. The media have changed. The world has changed. Somebody like Dwight Eisenhower would not be as popular today as a president of the United States as he was in the aftermath of the Second World War. We live in a different era, and yes, language has changed, and yes, politics has changed, of course.
What do you think, Daniela? Is it like all nostalgia falls into the same trap? Was it? It tends to forget the mediocre and inept of the time, of whatever it was. That when people are nostalgic for a particular period in music, they always forget the, you know, immense reams of rubbish that were produced at the same time. Is that what we're doing, or has politics changed? Or, I mean, obviously it's changed. Has it become debased, I guess, is the question.
Well, I think politics is always debased. From the first time a circle of cavemen and women started battling it out with stone hammers. This is nostalgia is utter nonsense. I feel none of it whatsoever, and it makes no sense to me. Like this nostalgia for the 1950s style cupcakes, which look very nice but actually nauseating to eat with all that buttercream on top. No, what we have, the politics of the 50s, even more so than today, we have an elite group of, you know, sorry to say this, mostly men, talking to an elite, much less accountable. And I mean, not that we live in some sort of ideal meritocracy now, and we can all laugh at Twitter and how ludicrous it's turned some aspects of politics into. But there's much more transparency. There's much more access. People are more accountable. So I think great. It sounds good, and it's an easy point to make. And it was funny, and I was laughing so hard I almost fell off my seat. But no nostalgia at all.
It needs perhaps to be said that even if you do go back several decades, not all political leaders were Dwight Eisenhowers. Demagogues, populists, ranting racists existed long before the 21st century. I don't have to name them. Everybody will know who they were. There have always been politicians who appealed to the basest instincts of the voters, and sometimes they have done extremely well. There have also, thank goodness, been statesmen and women who have appealed to the rather higher instincts of other humans, and sometimes they are victorious as well. There's good and bad. There is now, and there was then.
I think the problem is, to be serious again for a moment, is that we do seem to be living in an era of post-issue politics. So it is all about, it's about the sort of social media nonsense, and it's all about demographics, and it's all about ticking boxes rather than looking at issues and treating the electorate really as a little bit more, as if they're a bit more stupid than they really are. And I think that has been the payoff. I don't think that the opposite of elitist politics is populist politics, but perhaps that's where we are now.
It is an odd irony, isn't it? I mean, we live in an age when more information is available to more people more instantly than ever before. Everybody on the planet, just about, if they want to, can find out what's going on by means either of the internet or mobile telephones or whatever. And yet, as Daniela says, the preponderance of movement in politics seems to be away from facts, away from evidence, and in favour of appealing to emotions. There was a famous quote from one of the people campaigning in the EU referendum just a few months ago here, saying, facts don't count anymore. You have to appeal to people's feelings.
But just to follow that point up, I'm just wondering if politics maybe is learning the same lesson that the media learnt from online platforms, in that what we found out, those of us who worked for newspapers, what we suspected, I think, but what we found out for sure was that those lovingly written, sort of meticulously researched 5,000 word long reportage pieces, nobody read them. But you put in a picture of a skateboarding parrot and everybody loves it. Is politics now going through its equivalent realization?
It's heading in the same direction. I think politicians now understand that if they want to attract people's attention, then they have to find the political equivalent of the skateboarding parrot. It's not easy if you're a serious politician to try and sort of find a way of saying serious things but getting people to listen to you. People don't like listening to people being earnest and telling them everything is so complicated. They just want somebody to come and tell them, this is what we're going to do and it's going to be great. And that's Donald Trump's great strength. That's what he tells them. It may be complete and utter nonsense, but he's telling them what they want to hear.
Well, on a related or semi-related note, and our final topic for tonight, there's this.
I just want to know, I mean, have you called the French foreign minister, for instance?
No, but we're in the process of arranging for me to go to France and to Germany.
Do you know who he is?
Don't start pub quizzing me, Dermot.
He's the French foreign minister. Do you know his name?
No, and I'm not going to start answering your questions on this.
Well,
What really upsets me about your attitude to me is that you do this with me. I don't remember you doing it with anybody else, you know. It really upsets me that every time I come on here, you do another pub quiz with me because you do not do it with anybody else. Let me address it, Amrita. It's not,
because you are the shadow foreign secretary.
Yeah, right.
And this was about the French foreign minister, Jean-Marc Ayrault, who Boris Johnson has met.
Let's take this offline, because I've got a lot to say to you, and I don't think a lot of it ought to be broadcast.
Emily Thornby, for the time being, thank you very much indeed. More than keen to have that discussion on air if you like.
The UK Shadow Foreign Secretary, Emily Thornberry, and you can bet I checked that name twice, caught out this past weekend by an interviewer punting that she wouldn't be able to name France's foreign minister, or, as it turned out, the president of South Korea. But she's not the first office seeker to have been embarrassed in such a fashion. One of them went on to serve two terms as US president. So, does it really matter? First of all, can either of you name the foreign minister of France?
I can, because I looked it up after that particular broadcast, and I knew you were going to ask that, Andrew. I was ready. Monsieur Ayrault.
It was? President of South Korea? No, it's not. I think there was two presidents previously.
It's President Park.
It is President Park Geun-hye, the mayor of Wagga Wagga.
Oh, come now.
No, it's not. It's Rod Kendall, who I don't think I'm related to. Although, while we're up that way, one of my uncles was briefly deputy mayor of Tomboromba. This is a...
We didn't know that either.
It's an entirely true story. I fear we are deviating from the point somewhat. Daniela, does it really matter if a given political office holder cannot name another given political office holder when challenged so to do?
Yes, it does matter. It's the least you can expect. I mean, I imagine... politicians, like journalists, have to consume an awful lot of information for a short period of time. And as soon as they've used that information, it falls out of their head and then can be obtained another time by looking at some briefing notes. The bonus with being a journalist is that people have extremely low expectations of you. And the tragedy about Emily Thornberry is that, you know, it's possible to have really low expectations of a political figure and still...
have them exceeded, as it were.
Exactly.
But Robin, is there a politician alive really who you couldn't catch out like this if you really wanted to?
Of course, every politician can be caught out. I mean, it's the oldest and easiest trick in the book for any broadcast interviewer, the gotcha question. And there's a long and inglorious history going back to the British schools minister who couldn't say what 7 times 8 was. you mentioned the American president, George W. Bush, who couldn't name the president of Pakistan, which was embarrassing because at that time they were very close allies. There was David Cameron when he was prime minister a few years ago, who was famously asked the first question in an interview, do you know what a pink pussy and a slippery nipple are? And he... really didn't know how to answer that. It turned out they were cocktails made by a particular company in which he had shares. I mean, it's not serious interviewing, it's not serious journalism, it's not serious politics, it's entertainment. The problem with Emily Thornberry was that she didn't react to it properly. She should have just said to the interviewer, oh, come on, let's be serious.
And yet she didn't. Daniela, what did you make of the defence she attempted to put up that the interrogator, Dermot Murnaghan of Sky News, that is the right name, isn't it? It is. Was in some way being patronising / sexist.
/ mansplaining.
Exactly.
My response to that can't really be broadcast either. I mean, it's very...
Is it broadly in disagreement with Emily Thornberry?
It's broadly in disagreement. And I tried to watch the clip and just was physically incapable. I mean, I disagree with Robin because I think, okay, the pink pussy and the slippery nipple is like gorgeously frivolous. But I think, you know, that is sometimes a really basic journalism. You know, we can expect the shadow foreign minister to know the name of her French counterpart at this time. I think that's just basic. More recently, I think it was a few weeks ago, Boris Johnson got the Turkish coup mixed up with some sort of supposed crisis in Egypt, which you can only imagine that he thought, well, there must be a crisis. If there isn't one now, there'll be another one.
Will be when I invade the wrong country in response.
Exactly. So I think it is basic and sometimes it can be a bit of fun. But if you can't make the effort to remember that, to brief yourself and remember it for not for long, forget it after you're off air. You know, you're only human. But come on, you know, make an effort.
But Robin, as you said yourself, these things, it is the oldest trick in the book, especially for broadcast journalists. It is great entertainment, and as demonstrated by the fact that we're still talking about it 3 days later, it gets traction in a way that a more, I guess, mature interview would not. But where is the line? Where is it just cheap point scoring, and where is it actually a serious, sensible question?
I think it is reasonable to expect a potential foreign secretary, which is what Emily Thornberry is, to know the names of the major
use of the
world
word potential as well.
Well, she's the shadow foreign secretary. To know the names of major world leaders. She probably should have known the name of President of South Korea. The Foreign Minister of France, I don't wish to insult him, is not the most significant political figure in Europe. President Hollande of France is a significant figure, Chancellor Merkel of Germany. If she hadn't known those names, that would have been serious. The French foreign minister, I beg his pardon, is not in the top 10 of European leaders. Look, I've done enough broadcast interviews to know how easy it is to formulate a question that you know a politician will not be able to answer. It is easy to do, it's cheap, it's entertaining, but I just don't think it has much value.
Robin Lustig and Daniela Pellet, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House, which was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Luke Saunders. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. There's music next at 1900. It's Culture with Rob Bound, and there's more on the day's main stories on the Daily at 2200. I'm back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Goodbye. Thanks very much for listening.